Hello, I am Muneeb Ansari.
And I'm Rabia Malik.
Welcome to the Pakistan Development Podcast, a series of conversations about development in Pakistan, the policies, practices, and challenges, and how these issues relate to global trends.
For our first conversation, we spoke with Dr. Faisal Bari about education reform in Pakistan. He is the director at the Institute of Development and Economic Alternatives and an associate professor of economics at the Lahore University of Management Sciences. Dr. Bari has been involved with education policy research for about 10 years, and he has also been thinking about the big questions for education reform in Pakistan, which he often writes about in his bi-weekly column in Dawn newspaper. Dr. Bari, what explains Pakistan's low progress in getting all of its children in school and making sure they are learning?
I think so we have to realize how big a problem this is, right? These are, when we're talking about, when we say that 20 million children are out of school, 20 million is roughly the population that Canada actually has, right? So we're not talking of small numbers here. This is a 200 million roughly population in Pakistan, and you know, most of them are young, and you have passed a 18th amendment that says 25A that 5 to 16 year old all need to have access to free and compulsory education, right? So the size of the problem is very large. If you historically look at it, I think we've come a long way from where we were, in the sense that our GERs now in the primary level across most of the country are in the 80s and 90% gross enrollment rates are at the gender gap has come down a little, and at the secondary level, in fact, the gender gap is almost, at least in urban areas, almost non-existent. So there has been a lot of progress, and the scale at which education is now available, whether private or public, has never been there before. So I don't think it's fair to actually say that we have not made any progress in it. But the problem is very large. What we haven't done is given it enough importance. Yes, I agree. So for, despite all the rhetoric, for example, we've never been able to spend more than 2-odd% of our GDP on education, whereas mostly internationally, minimum of 4% is recommended, and then usually countries spend a lot more than that on education, right? We haven't been able to regulate the private sector. We haven't been able to provide quality education through the public sector, right? So a lot of those things we haven't been able to do, but that is not to deny that a child growing up in today in Pakistan in some ways has access to education which might not have been available, say, 30 years, 40 years ago. Of course, the differences in education have increased a lot as well. Because we've allowed an elite private sector to come in, what has happened is that the equity issues have become a lot more entrenched, and the elites and middle and upper classes have shifted out of public schools and have gone to these elite schools with very high fees, and that has that by definition is increasing the inequalities in our society, and they will become a lot more entrenched due to the educational process. And those inequalities are not just about being in a separate school for elites. It's also that they get educated in English. They are not even exposed to the same kind of, to the children from other classes, like if they were in public school, they would be. They are not even sharing the same culture and the same environment as the rest of society and so on. So these things will increase inequality intergenerationally significantly as well.
How is education reform being thought about in Pakistan?
Overriding imperatives for education reform are still very much issues of access. Now, there is some emphasis on the question of quality, but I think still the overriding imperative has been how do you get all children or as many children as possible into schools? And all the reforms are actually geared towards that as well. So how do you encourage parents to enroll? So there have been enrollment drives, and similarly civil society has also focused a lot on that, like Alif Elan. And then donor policies have also focused a lot more on primary level and that issue of enrollment. Then the other issue that has come in as well, how do you provide all the teachers that are required for the primary and also how do you get them to show up for school so that the primary etc. can be completed. So reform has to do with accountability and monitoring of teachers. It has to do with ensuring they're there so that enrollment drives can happen. And it has to do with making sure that all children are in schools. And encouraging the private sector also has to do with exactly that, enrollment.
So if we're thinking only about access at the moment, and we've been thinking about access for a long time, is there no reform at all that's focusing beyond that on quality?
There are smaller reforms that are starting to focus on quality. For example, so if you think about teachers, let's say almost all of the provinces now have either have or are bringing in continuous professional development programs, mentorship programs for their teachers and so on. They have done a lot of changes in most provinces in teacher recruitment processes to make them less open to corruption and nepotism. And similarly, in some other areas, for example, in books, textbooks, at least on paper, governments have made the change that now they allow private sector to include textbooks in the process of selection for government school textbooks as well. They haven't yet opened up the market completely, but nonetheless, they are moving in that direction. And even on assessment, with the creation of Punjab Examination Commission, I think Punjab at least has taken a step in thinking about how to make the assessment process a lot more scientific and a lot more based on evidence and history and so on. We haven't gotten there yet because we haven't been able to do the reforms fully, but at least there is recognition that all of these things need to happen eventually.
How much of it, in terms of reform, how much of it is a question of resources and how much of it is things other than resources, for example, smart policy.
I think actually resources is an issue, but it has always been blown up,
right?
Because people, you know, it's very easy to hang on to saying 2% or 4% of GDP and so on. Resources are an issue, but that's not the main problem. The main problem is how do you conceptualize the entire, what is the ultimate in equilibrium notion of an education sector that you have in mind. If what you have in mind is what is happening right now, divisions between private versus public, madrasa versus others, division of what a child has access to depending on her gender or her income, her parental income, her geography, or a lot of other things, including disability and so on. If that's the case, that's what your vision is, you're heading in the right direction because you're already allowing all these things to happen. The problem is that there isn't a very nice, coherent conceptualization either by the state, the politicians, or by the society as to what kind of an educational system eventually we want for every child in the country. And unless you have that, it's very hard to figure out what kind of policy would be optimal, what things you won't allow to happen, what things you will allow to happen. Here's a very simple example. I mean, today we have schools that are free, government schools, and we have schools that charge about 50, 60,000 rupees a month as tuition fee, right? Those schools, that kind of differences in diversity probably, if you want education to be free and compulsory and the right of every child, that kind of diversity is just not conducive to what you're trying to do there. So it's as obvious as that. So what you need to do is have an overall conceptualization of where you want to go as a society and then try to judge individual things by that criteria and figure out how do you want to regulate these things and so on. That part is completely missing. And that leads us to actually all sorts of problems where we don't have, in a way, a standard by which to judge what sort of regulation we want to bring, what the notion of optimality is, and what would be the notion of desirable versus non-desirable policy.
How have other countries dealt with tensions between individual benefit, which prompts exit from low-quality public schools, and the collective benefit, which requires a broad demographic to engage with the question of public education?
So, I mean, the movement for mass education historically has different roots in different countries. But one thing that appears to be common, at least to me, in a lot of those conversations, is the notion of a crisis, where actually the elites and the politicians and everyone realizes that the way to solve the crisis is to actually educate everyone and see that as a public good and as a necessary thing for the survival of the nation, country. So if you look at Japan, for example, they did that in the after the Meiji Revolution, which was a long time ago. And, you know, there's another myth that we need to get around, the resources myth. When Japan went for mass education, they were not as rich as they are now. Right? And they nonetheless chose to go for mass education and find the resources that will allow them to do that. Same thing for a lot of the European countries. Today, we obviously can't give the example of Finland and Sweden because they are very rich. But when they actually went for mass education, they were not as rich as they are today. And the same for US and UK and everyone else. So this myth of that we are not rich enough and therefore we can't provide good quality mass education is, in my opinion, more of a myth than reality. It's actually the decision of a society. Do you want to go in that direction or not? And I think in a lot of those countries, if you look at the historical literature, it's a crisis in some ways that challenged the nation and challenged the notion of self-interest of an elite or of a parent, etc., that it's not enough to just educate my child. It's important to educate everyone's child if this country is going to survive for all of us. Right? And I think that sense of crisis, where in US it was because people were coming from all sorts of parts of the world, and they thought that if they didn't create a melting pot in one America through the education system, an America will not exist. Right? People will be Irish, Italian, Canadian, Irish, Italian, French, British, whatever, but they will not be American. So the need for mass education came from that. In a lot of Europe, this was in the aftermath of the Industrial Revolution, and in the need to create a much more skilled labor force, but also in the need to formulate a way of dealing with poverty as well. So anti-poverty laws, etc., started coming in, started regulating the number of hours you can could employ children for, or eventually remove children from the workplace and so on. And with that came mass education and the realization that we have to do this to make these countries develop a lot more. I think in Pakistan, still, the elites are actually looking at it as a private good issue, that if their child gets the best of education, that's the way to move forward for their children, their family. But what they're not thinking of is what we can call enlightened self-interest, that it is in my self-interest actually to educate the child of everyone in the country, for even if they can't afford it, for the simple reason that it's a public good, and an uneducated child is a burden and is not reaching their potential, which would be possible only if they were educated. That notion of crisis, till it happens, I think it's very hard for me to see the elite waking up.
So last time we met, you called us monkeys. Can you explain this concept of monkeys and morons and as it relates to Pakistan and its education system?
So this example actually comes from, to the best of my memory, so I can't be very sure, but I think it comes from Akhtar Hamid Saab, the OPP founder. Or Komila Project founder. He said once, our education system is only producing two kinds of people, monkeys or morons. Monkeys are those who ape the West, and morons are those who can't even do that. Right? And so the choice is, I think the distinction he's making is that our education system either just copies whatever is being done in the West, or we go to the West to get educated, etc., and do not develop an indigenous way of looking, contextualizing our problems, like OPP did for Karachi and for an urban area, or Komila had done before that in East Pakistan. Either we do that, or we don't get educated at all, or get educated through a system that only glorifies rata and emulation, and nothing original in that either. So it's the choice between those two. My feeling is what he was arguing for, and this is my reading of the example, was that what we need is an indigenized system that gives a lot more importance to local context, creating local knowledge and local solutions to the problems. Even after, Akhtar Saab has been gone for some time, but I don't still, even today, don't see us moving from either of these poles to something that is much more contextualized and local, and also shows the effort that is needed to create something like that.
What do you mean by contextualization?
Contextualization does not mean so when you can't contextualize, let's say, mathematics much. Maths is going to be maths, right? You can use the medium of instruction as Urdu or Angrezi or whatever in teaching maths, but maths is going to be maths. You can't have a different maths for Punjab and a different maths for science. You might choose to do different things in the sense that ratios or division might be done in grade 3 or grade 4 by one province, but it will be ratio and division nonetheless. Same thing for a lot of science as well. Now, where contextualization, I think, is more important, one is in history, social studies, civics, any ethical studies, etc., that you want your children, the selection of literature that you want your children to go through. That, and also the second contextualization is, what are the problems that you're trying to solve for the children? As in, what are the things that you want them to take as examples of what they should link their knowledge to? Right, so if you are in Punjab, for example, and in rural area, should you not have something that has to do with animal husbandry and agriculture, in addition to, say, a lot of the things that you want to give them in science and maths, other than that also? Contextualization could mean a reflexiveness to, a reflexivity to their living conditions as well. Right, they have to deal with certain things, why not bring them into the classroom as well? So that's another way of looking at contextualization.
Can you speak to us about the intersection between the medium of instruction and how it relates to learning?
We have a lot of evidence that in the initial years, when the child is very young, the way to teach them and let them develop their conceptual framework is through their mother tongue. So that's a fairly well-recognized body of literature which says that there's advantages to using the mother tongue to teach the child. Now, wherever we are in Pakistan, we do have a number of local languages that act as mother tongue. So Punjab, Punjabi, Sindhi, Pashto, and so on and so forth. Now, you could very easily start the child in their mother tongue so that they can relate to whatever is happening in their house and in their own locality, and that allows them to think deeper and develop conceptually. And then there is always a transition of languages that happen in all countries from mother tongue to other languages that you want to give to the child as well. So in the early years, you start English, Urdu, etc. after you started teaching them in their mother tongue, and you bring in English, Urdu, etc. as subjects very early on, so that by grade 5 or 6, they are fluent in all of those languages, including obviously their mother tongue. And then you can choose the medium of instruction for later years, whichever language you want to do that. But the medium of instruction issue and acquisition of language issue are two separate things. You cannot learn a language by having the medium of instruction in that language. That's a misnomer, right? You can't teach children English by just saying, I'm going to teach maths and science also in English. You teach maths and science to teach maths and science, whichever language they are most comfortable with. And you teach English as a language as early as you want, as well as you want, but that doesn't have to be the medium of instruction as well. Right? So the two are very different things. And once you have the child conversant in some of these languages, then you can have whatever medium of instruction you want after grade 7, 8, whatever you want in that sense.
In part 2, we talked to Dr. Bari about education policy and how it's made and by whom it's made in Pakistan. You can listen to all of our episodes and comment on them at pakistandevelopmentpodcast.wordpress.com. Thank you for listening.